Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How important is privacy, and what plays into our decisions about what information to keep to ourselves and what to share? In a decade where a trip on an airplane requires a full body scan, a typical social life includes frequent online postings about our daily thoughts, activities, even meals, and a stroll through the nearest town square or shopping center is almost guaranteed to include being captured by security cameras, privacy might seem to be a commodity we no longer value. In his new book on the subject, my guest today explores the way our relationship to privacy has changed and argues it remains important not only as a tool for managing our lives, but for resisting invasions of basic human rights and dignity. Garrett Kaiser is a contributing editor of Harper's Magazine and a former Guggenheim Fellow. His new book, part of Picador's Big Ideas Small Book series, is called Privacy. Garrett, welcome back to Think.
Well, thank you for having me back.
You open this book by pointing out that when we use the word share these days, we are far more likely to be referring to information than to wealth. That's a pretty remarkable development.
Yes, and I'm so glad you cite that sentence, it being one of my favorites in the book. And I'm probably being somewhat facetious. I'm not sure that sharing wealth has ever been high on our list of priorities, especially if we're the ones who have it. But it does seem that whenever sharing enters our discourse, it's much more likely to refer to the disclosure of the minutiae of our lives as opposed to enabling all of us to eat.
What is privacy? Is it a fundamental concept or one that truly means different things depending on the person and every circumstance in which it's employed?
Well, I would say the quick answer to what you said is both. I would argue that privacy, at least as I would define it, as a kind of elemental, creaturely resistance to being used or interfered with or trapped or penetrated against our will is fundamental. I think at this point in our legal history in the United States, most people would regard it as a fundamental right, at least in name. But there are, of course, many variations on how different individuals conceive of privacy or in how they would exercise their right to privacy. But that really goes to the core of many working definitions of privacy, which have to do with an individual's right to control access to the self or access to spaces, to information, to other things that contribute to one's sense of the self. So that diversity, that degree of choice is built in almost into the concept.
What do we fail to fully consider when we conflate privacy with solitude?
Well, a few things. When we use privacy and solitude synonymously, there are, I think, at least two major things we fail to consider. The first of these is choice. I would conceive of privacy as existing only where there is freedom of choice, just as I would consider sexuality as existing only when there is freedom of choice. When there isn't, it's something else called rape. And not everyone who's solitary chooses to be solitary. If one does choose to be solitary, the right that protects that choice is something that we would call privacy. There's something else almost as important that we can miss. And that is that our tendency, or maybe I should speak for my own tendency when I use the word privacy, is to think of myself as a solitary individual. I'm private, and I'm in my bathroom. But privacy also protects what legal scholars call the freedom of intimate association. In other words, privacy isn't just about me. It's about my right to form associations and relationships with other people, to have conversations with other people, and to have that disclosure, that mutual disclosure, which I and my intimate other have opted for, respected. And there may even be one more piece, which is that I think it's possible to look at privacy, and I do look at it in the book, not only as a right between persons or that a solitary person has, but as a kind of show of respect toward other people. We tend to think of, you know, privacy in terms of, you know, you violating my rights. But there may also be a piece of it that has to do with me respecting you enough not to put my life in your face. The English essayist Charles Lamb has a delightful essay, which I quote in my book, called A Bachelor's Complaint, in which he talks about his married friends, as it were, parading their affections in front of him. And it's not that he's a prude, but he sees this as disrespect toward his status as a single man who might not enjoy all of those amenities, and yet he feels that his married hosts are not showing a proper regard for his solitary state.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting when you wrote about this. You even mentioned the fact that, you know, if you go to a hotel room and spend the night, you know that a maid will come in and clean up after you each day. And just there's a small amount of simple tidying that you do simply so that you don't parade whatever it is that went on, even, you know, as regards to pretty normal things the night before.
Yeah, and I think that that's a show of respect, and to some extent it's predicated on a sense of that housekeeper's equality or proximate equality with you. In other words, would you want your neighbors, your associates at work, to see some of those evidences? If you don't care about the housekeeper seeing them, it may be because you regard her as a kind of subspecies of human being or worker. As soon as you start taking her into the sphere of neighborhood, then you are going to be more likely to show him or her the same respect and discretion that you would show among your neighbors, assuming you know them and care about them too.
So there are really multiple dimensions to this relationship between privacy and social class.
Yes, and that's really one of the major themes of my book, is the relationship between privacy and social class. That people who have less of the goods of life tend to enjoy less privacy, and people who have the lion's share of the goods of material and social life tend to have an abundance. And I also make the case that as the discrepancy between those who have and those who have not widens, then we're also looking at an erosion of that very social contract on which privacy depends. Here again, and this goes back to your very good question about solitude, there's something inherently misleading in that automatic sort of knee-jerk response to the word privacy, in terms of seeing it as, you know, it's me, and it's about me, and it's about my right to be away from other people. Well, it is that. But the right to be by yourself, or the right to have your affairs respected as belonging to you, depends on others. It's our togetherness that permits us to be apart. And when that social contract is eroded, as I believe it is being eroded, it should come as no surprise that our privacy is being eroded, just as it should come as no surprise that in a time of climate change, you know, there's a little less of your beach each year.
You share a story from your own life in which you were incensed to learn that a friend of yours had broken what you saw as a sort of sacred trust between you by sharing the contents of letters that you had meant for his eyes only. And what was stunning for you to discover was that your friend truly didn't understand initially why you were so angry about this.
No, he did not. And of course, that indicates that we do have this measure of difference And increasingly, I guess, as I grow older, although my friend, who continues to be my friend and who was even acting, I think, in friendship when he did share the letters, mm-hmm. he thought that they were nice things to share. But it does underscore that as I grow older, certain things that I might have regarded as norms that I could assume are not necessarily so. It isn't that people deliberately and willingly wish to violate my privacy as an act of aggression, although there are people out there, of course, who are happy to do that, but that there are also people who never in a million years would want to hurt you or betray your trust, but they're just operating according to a different set of cultural norms that we assume to our peril. I mean, I'm to the point now that if I send someone an email, which I've always viewed as just sort of an extension of the letters that I post in envelopes, although obviously they're not necessarily secure either, as evidenced by that example, but where I'll send an email and I'll just sort of politely say that this is not something that I wish to have forwarded. This is meant for you. And I sometimes find it a little bit disconcerting that people apparently almost feel that they're not worthy of a communication that would be directed to them alone.
Hmm.
I mean, there's a kind of compliment, I think, in sending someone a letter, you know, and pouring out your thoughts. And the implication of that is you and you alone were worth this time. You and you alone are worthy of this degree of disclosure, of intimacy and communication. And it's a privilege that I hope everyone is able to experience on both the giving and the receiving end, though I also fear, perhaps in a fuddy-duddy way, that it's a privilege that may be deteriorating.
Well, I don't think you're a fuddy-duddy, but it did strike me a moment ago, Garrett. You used this word post, and you used it in the traditional sort of classic sense of putting something in an envelope, sending it through the mail. The new meaning of that word is post on a Facebook page, in a public forum, in the same way that people post bills on a fence. That word has taken a very different turn in the past decade or so.
Well, I guess so, and suffice it to say, I don't do a whole lot of the latter posting, and not of my mail, and never without some trepidation. Yes, and I have a chapter in the book actually called Letters, where I talk about the shift in correspondence from the posted in the sense of stamped and delivered letter to the email, and some what I see as parallel developments, not the least of which is our opting for the private corporation as opposed to the public servant to be the intermediary in conveying our communication. In other words, we go with Google and Yahoo instead of with the postman or the postwoman. And I think that is indicative of other shifts toward greater and greater privatization in terms of public institutions, accompanied by decreasing privacy.
Garrett Kaiser is my guest. He's a contributing editor of Harper's Magazine and a former Guggenheim Fellow. You can join our discussion about his new book, Privacy, by calling us now. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Harper's Magazine contributing editor and former Guggenheim fellow Garrett Kaiser. We're talking about his new book, Privacy. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Garrett, we have decided over time that privacy is implied in many ways by the Fourth Amendment, but famously the word does not appear in the Bill of Rights or, in fact, anywhere in the Constitution. Talk a little bit about how our recognition of the value of privacy has evolved over time.
Well, I would just start by saying that our recognition of the right of privacy and our use of the word privacy are not necessarily the same thing. So there can be recognition of love in a relationship long before anyone says, I love you. Hmm. And I would argue, and I'm sure others would disagree, that the foundations for a right to privacy are in our Constitution and certainly in the Bill of Rights. But as you point out, the word does not appear in a U.S. court case until an 1881 decision by the Michigan Supreme Court. Discussion of the word in the right is much enhanced when Louis Brandeis and Samuel Warren write an article in the Harvard Law Review called Right to Privacy in 1890. It's an article that's still being discussed, but we don't get the word privacy until 1928. And it is also in that decision that Louis Brandeis spoke of a right to be let alone, although he did not coin that phrase. And then we have other court cases that come after that, most famously cases like Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, which was which struck down laws making it illegal to sell contraceptives, Roe v. Wade in 73, the striking down of anti-sodomy statutes in Lawrence versus Texas in 2003. And just in the current session of the U.S. Supreme Court, three decisions that that have an impact for our understanding of privacy. So that concept just legally continues to evolve, especially as contemporary jurists try to parse out the meaning of the Fourth Amendment in a digital age that includes technological devices that the founders could not even have imagined. And it also continues to develop culturally. I mean, a legal right is something like a language. Languages get discussed by grammarians and professors, but some of the stuff, and I would argue the most important stuff, is happening on the street. And I think the same is true of our rights, that the influence goes up as well as down.
Well, there's an interesting tension that exists between our expectation that the government can help protect our privacy, given that in many cases government activities and policies might also invade our privacy, and the reality that we think, at least in this democratic society, that the best government is a government in which there is very little privacy, that they have to operate completely in the open.
Well, you raise a few very good points. First of all, our government, our political system is based on the idea that government will be transparent. One of the first things that the framers of the Constitution insisted on was the keeping of a congressional record so that what Congress did would be a matter of the public record, without which they saw self-government very difficult. They also put in protections to give a reasonable protection to the private affairs of individuals. And in some ways, some have argued, and I would tend to agree, that we've reversed, we put shoes on the wrong feet, and that now we have a government that is increasingly less transparent and individuals walking around congratulating themselves for their transparency and openness. we do look to our government both to protect our privacy, and we fear its invasion of our privacy. And that fear is not something new. In fact, you know, the Bill of Rights, from which most scholars would say we derive at least our legal right of privacy, was those amendments were added by people who were fearful of government and fearful that government would overstep its powers and who insisted on those protections. So there's always been that fear, and that's good for us as citizens in the sense that we have a foundation for some foundation for resisting the encroachments of government. Where it's less good is that we keep looking for the arrows to fly through one window even as they're coming at us from another. We are at a point now where corporations and even private individuals have unprecedented powers for looking into our private affairs, and yet I think most of us continue, not without some justification, to see the major threat coming from government. But government's not the only threat, and of course one could argue who runs the government. And there again, you come up against corporate power and the dictates of the corporate system.
Yeah, that's a great point and a good jumping off point, because we assume that we run the government and that at some point we'll be able to exercise control over its invasions of our privacy. On the other hand, we sort of willingly give information to these corporate entities that we have no claim of control over, other than the fact that we can either utilize their business or not.
Yes, and I think that, you know, in some ways that's frightening, or at least it's frightening to me, that at least notionally we have some say in how the government runs. We can hold government officials accountable. There's apparatus for doing that, but none of that exists in regard to private corporations. There's been legislation around, and I can't cite you the exact act, I could find it somewhere, but around the disclosure of Social Security numbers, but it only affects government agencies. So government agencies have some constraints on their use of our Social Security numbers, but if private corporations have our Social Security numbers, there's a much less, there are fewer checks on their exploitation of that information.
Why do you think, is it an illusion that we have that when we put information out there and entrust it to corporate entities, that we somehow have control over that information? Because that's been proven wrong time and time again, and yet people sort of voluntarily put out very personal information, assuming that because they are the originators of that, they will have control over what happens to it.
Well, I think there is an illusion. And, you know, I don't want to do a Chicken Little routine that you know, a discussion of privacy can degenerate into an exercise in paranoia. But I do think there are illusions that we suffer in regard to our privacy. And off the top of my head, I can think of at least two. One is an illusion that's dictated by, in some degrees, by the technology through which we give our information and receive our information. And that is, for many of us, that's done in what seems like an incredibly private place. In other words, we have our own personal computer. We're not even at the library unless we're, you know, those poor people. And we're in our own room, and so there's that illusion that we're by ourselves when we are in fact not. And I think that's particularly pointed and poignant, too, in the case of younger folk who maybe are a little more naive about what appears to be privacy but in fact isn't. I think there's also an illusion that comes out of what I see, anyway, as a feature of global consumer capitalism as we now know it, which is that we're repeatedly offered a myriad of choices in regard to relatively trivial things, even as much larger decisions are removed. So we have our eye on this great phantasmagoria of choices and decisions, none of which amount to all that much. And while we're mesmerized with that, more fundamental rights are taken away. It's interesting, a few days ago I had someone ask me a question. He said, well, you know, what do you think of these employers that that demand their employees' Facebook passwords in order to get a job? And I said, well, that's a good question, but let's ask a better one. What do you think of employers who presuppose that every employable human being has a Facebook page? So in other words, you're offered choices on how to construct your Facebook page. You can put 5 friends on there. You can put 100 friends on there. You can like this. You can dislike that. Wow, look at all I'm exercising as a free and independent individual. But your right to exist as a respectable member of society without a Facebook page, that decision is slowly being pulled away from you. So we have this illusion that corporations are highly responsive to our desires, even as some of our more fundamental desires are being ignored on the one hand, and also to some extent, I think, as our desires are being dictated to us. And that's nothing new, and that certainly predates much of what we mean when we call technology, the idea that the market creates the need that it then satisfies. Or, and this is related to privacy too, that it creates a set of needs so that it can double dip. So that what it does is it takes the vitamins out of the bread and sells you the bread, and then it sells you the vitamins. It gives you the ability to kill fish with your sound system, and then it also gives you noise-reducing headphones. And after you've bought the one, you can buy the other. And likewise, it gives us this kind of escalating privacy arms race online where we can buy various security systems, and then we can also buy the means to violate those systems. And in some cases, these contraries are actually sold and marketed by the same corporations.
We've also lost touch with the idea that every single one of us has certain things that we share with a limited group of individuals, whether that be our family or our close friends or people within our religious institutions, information that we share, that doesn't necessarily mean that that information belongs to the wider world. And somehow when technology is there as an intermediary, those lines get blurred that are not blurry in the real world.
Yeah, and there's another, a very good example of what we were talking about before, where an appearance of choice masks the disappearance of choice, the removal of choice. In this case, the choice to decide how you're going to disclose yourself, to what degree and to what people. And there is a kind of pressure, and it's certainly not limited to technology. We can even find it wrapped into some of our legal decisions, to regard privacy as kind of an all-or-nothing proposition. In other words, if you're at home and you've got those shades drawn, you have a right to privacy. But once you go to school or step into the workplace, certainly once you step online, then you are in the so-called public domain where you have virtually no reasonable expectation of privacy at all, which strikes me as analogous to that old notion that, you know, if a woman stays at home and never goes abroad without a male escort, and always makes sure that she's covered right from her neck to the tips of her toes, she has a reasonable expectation of going in society and not being molested. But if she's a little more daring in her attire or her companionship, or sexual experience, then she has no one but herself to blame if she's harassed or assaulted. I think most people have seen that for the load of nonsense that it is, but they don't always see it in regard to their privacy or to the privacy of others. That when we enact that kind of almost prudish notion of all or nothing in regard to your privacy, we're really making life a good deal less lovely and sinuous than it could be. And we're also affecting democracy. And it's a point that I'm not the first to make, and I hope I'm not the last to make, that the public and the private are not opposites. They're different sides of the same coin, and they're mutually supportive. So the health of a democracy and the health of privacy are connected. Privacy allows those individuals and those groups that you were talking about to form their ideas. It's not just one big, loud free-for-all of everybody shouting in the same room, although our public discourse can increasingly come to seem that way. But when it's functioning in a healthy way, it's small groups. It's individuals. It's people talking on their coffee breaks. It's people talking with the bed covers pulled right up to their necks, conspiring, as it were, but not all conspiracies are bad, to bring certain ideas into the public square. To react to things that have happened. And as I say in my book, privacy also gives the opportunity to those of us who might be a little more shy, who might be a little less quick on our feet. It gives those of us who fall into that category the space to form some of our ideas before we dress them up and bring them out in the open. And when all there is open, then that opportunity decreases, and the open air itself begins to stink because there's no freshness brought into it out of private places.
We're speaking this hour with Garrett Keyser. He's a contributing editor of Harper's Magazine and a former Guggenheim Fellow. His new book is called Simply Privacy. If you would like to join our conversation, perhaps share what your idea of privacy is and how it is reflected in the modern world or not, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Garrett Keyser, who's a contributing editor of Harper's Magazine and author of the new book, Privacy. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Garrett, I want to talk for a minute about the places where this sacred notion for us as journalists of the public's right to know and the function that serves in terms of bringing wrongdoing to light and sort of stopping people who might be causing abuses. That comes up against certain information that individuals might want to keep to themselves and might, in fact, have good reason to want to keep to themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether maybe it doesn't seem as if the media and journalists are struggling with this notion at all anymore and everything has become something the public has a right to know?
Well, you've touched on a very tension that has been in our society for a long time between the freedom of the press and the right to privacy. And in fact, the article I mentioned earlier in the program that Brandeis and Warren had written on the right to privacy specifically zeroed in on what they saw as the outrages of a yellow journalism press. I think that as long as our society continues in recognizable form, that we are going to have some tension between the public's right to know and the right to privacy. And, you know, there are tensions between values all over the place. I think the danger comes when we want to resolve that tension, as you suggested might be the case, where we give up and instead of maintaining the tension through weighing individual cases one at a time, through development of responsible journalistic ethics, through the protection of our First Amendment rights to freedom of the press, freedom of the freedom of speech, that if we lose that tension, then I think we lose everything overall. However, I think there are some questions to be brought to this discussion, and naturally I'm bringing them from the privacy side. And one of the things that I would ask is how much of what we regard as the public's right to know is the right to know the information we need for self-government, how much of it is the itch to know what we want for prurient interest. Hmm. So, and I think that that this is more than a hypothetical question. I think that in some ways, the second thing I mentioned is being used as a cover for the first. So in other words, you know, name me the movie star and I can tell you who she slept with. I can tell you when she had her latest so-called wardrobe malfunction. But can I tell you what the profit sheets were for ExxonMobil for the last 10 years? Can I tell you whether my own phone has been tapped? I live over the hills from a lawyer who represents someone imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay and who has good reason to believe his phone's been tapped and can't get an answer to that question. But he can get an answer about, you know, who J-Lo is running with right now, or married to, or whatever. I don't keep up on Ms. Lopez a lot. But there needs to be a freedom of the press. However, why were we granted that freedom in the first place? And there are people running around who believe that that means that anything they might care to know, they have a right to know, and the only thing that prevents them from knowing it is means. In other words, if you can't quite jimmy the lock, then you don't know it. But if there's a way to do it, then you have a right to know that. And I think in some ways they're like dogs chasing their tails. They're settling for this information which is not important to the exercise of their function as a self-governing people, even as they're losing wide bits of a wide swaths of knowledge that they require. And I do think that in some ways the loss of the newspaper and the loss of media outlets where trained journalists discussed these matters among themselves and operated by a code of ethics, that we're losing some of that. The other thing to add, and then I should stop, is that behind this question, as behind all the other questions in our society, is a matter of money. So we have this discussion on the radio, and we're talking, you and I, about the public's right to know versus the right to privacy. But behind all that, there are persons and entities saying, which is going to make us a buck? Hmm. And if it's preserving privacy, privacy will be preserved. And if it's a matter of selling the newspapers, as in the, you know, Rupert Murdoch phone hacking scandal over in Great Britain, when media are owned by magnates, then they are going to determine ultimately the ethics, and the ethics are the bucks.
It is astonishing that anybody in this day and age is just dying to be famous, don't you think?
Well, it is astonishing, and maybe it isn't. It's astonishing, certainly, to those of us who remember, or at least felt on some level, what Voltaire said, that it is a terrible burden to have a name that's too famous. But I think that people hunger for fame, and especially young people, and I think that there are reasons that they do. I think especially in the case of young people are not as stupid as we make them out to be. They can discern the difference between what we say is good and what we mean is good, and they can do it based on where we spend our bucks. Who makes the most money in our society? Who gets the most acclaim? Can you or I identify the face of the surgeon who developed the serum that saved us from developing polio? But we can identify whichever airhead is now being held up for our adulation. And I think young people see this, and I think that the exposure of their own privacy gives them a way to participate in that mystique. Even deeper than that, I think people crave celebrity or crave information about celebrity, crave to pry into other people's lives because of a lack of acknowledgement in their own. You know, the philosopher Hegel said that one of the most fundamental human needs and motivations was for some kind of recognition, to be recognized, to be seen as who you are. I would invite your listeners to think of, you know, the best experiences of their lives, the best dates, the best dinners, and weren't they occasions where you felt you were really seeing somebody and they were really seeing you? You were hearing and you were being heard. And I think that in our culture, where there's a fair amount of alienation for various reasons, that people lack that need. And so they find some pathetic compensation for it in voyeurism, in looking into other people's lives, which maybe will be more interesting than their own, or in exposing their own in the hopes that other people might find them interesting. So that's why I never look at that kind of exposure with contempt, although it concerns me, because it has to do with needs, with deep-seated human needs that are not being met. I sometimes offer the little exercise that a person can do. Think, you know, do a little mental computation. Think of the people you know who have meaningful work and nourishing relationships and a sensuous enjoyment of life, and the economic means that enable all those things and derive from all those things. And how many of those people do you know who are like, you know, displaying their bare buttocks on Facebook or rifling through people's trash to find out if there are any love letters in there? They don't do that because their own lives are too interesting to give up in order to do that. When we see lots of people who can't make that claim, that's a reason to be concerned, not to be contemptuous, but to be concerned.
It's also true that we run the risk of misinterpreting information that wasn't meant to belong to us in the first place. And you remind us here of the very sad story of Tyler Clementi. This is the college student who committed suicide after learning that his roommate had videotaped him in a physical encounter with another young man. Conventional wisdom has it everyone assumed that Tyler Clementi took his own life because he was discovered to be gay. And you say there's no reason necessarily to assume that is what upset him so much.
Yes, and it's interesting that, you know, I was writing about the Tyler Clementi case as soon as I was started to write about the book, but more and more came out about it as the book was in development. And one of the things that came out, which I did not know at the first, is that Tyler Clementi had already come out as a gay young man to his family and to at least one close friend. So the idea that he committed suicide because he didn't want anyone to know he was gay is somewhat shaky, although I suppose it's conceivable that he committed suicide because he didn't want everybody in the world to know he was gay, which I would maintain is part of his right of privacy to decide to what degree he wishes to expose information about himself. I tend to think, perhaps in the self-serving manner of an author with a subject and an axe to grind, that Tyler Clementi took his life because the thought of living in a world where there was no trust, where there was no honor, where there were none of those underpinnings to what we call privacy, was not a world worth living in. That if it was impossible even to have an encounter, a tentative encounter, and I'm not young and I'm not gay, so and I'm not young in 2012, so I have no idea what courage it would take someone in his shoes just to follow his own heart, just to feel his own way through that very, very dark mysterium of sexuality, which is hard enough if you conform to society's norms, but can be very, very hard if you don't. And then to discover that certain elemental things that he thought he could count on, if only just some fellow feeling among the people he literally slept with in his dorm and passed on the way to lunch. Although I wish he hadn't committed suicide, and if I could talk to him, I would have given him every argument in the book against it. I can understand why, in a moment of stress, he would have said, if this is the world that I live in, you can keep it.
What do we need to consider? What do we need to do to remind ourselves that we need to consider other people's decisions about their own personal information rather than simply sharing things as soon as we hear them?
Well, this will probably sound trite, but some things sound trite because they're enduring, and I think an exercise of what is sometimes called the golden rule, or if that sounds too sanctimonious, I suppose we could say just looking at our own desires and needs and assuming that we're not so unique that other people might not have the same is a starting place. What am I? And then I suppose beyond that, recognizing that our own desires and needs are not necessarily normative, because some people will say, well, since I don't have any problem with other people knowing this about me, then therefore no one else has any legitimate reason to have a problem with me knowing those things about them, which is sort of the height of egotism. You know,
right.
I as the norm of the universe. I also think that, you know, people can discover some of the value of this by testing the boundaries of certain norms and expectations, which can be a very empowering experience. So someone comes to tell you something that about a third party that you gather that third party would not want you to know, and you dare to say, you know what, I like you very much, and I know you're just telling me this in friendship, but I don't really want to know it. Or somebody comes up to you and asks you a question, and you just say, with respect, why do you need to know this? Or, you know, you're standing at a counter somewhere applying for something and somebody is asking you 10 questions. They only really need to know the answer to 3, and they're probably only legally entitled to ask you 1, but you want to be a good sport, so you answer all 10. How about saying, you know, I'm sorry, why do I need to say this, and who else is a party to this information? It's the first step toward feeling more like a human being and less like a sheep.
Garrett Kaiser's new book is called Privacy. Garrett, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, the pleasure is always mine when I'm on the show. Thanks.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can get the podcast free every day online at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.